It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Biden gave his first State of the Union address last night. We'll talk to a Wisconsin political scientist about what we heard and about the Republican response to the speech. First, Wisconsin is well known now as a political battleground state, sometimes seen as a predictor of trends at the national level. But it hasn't always been that way, and not all issues are the same in Wisconsin as they are in other parts of the country. A group of current and former UW-Madison professors wrote a new book looking at the media channels and communication dynamics that help shape Wisconsin's partisan divides. The book's called Battleground: Asymmetric Communication Ecologies and the Erosion of Civil Society in Wisconsin. We're learning more about the research and its findings with two of the authors now, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. How divided do you think Wisconsin is, more than you remember in the past? What is your media diet? Where does your political information come from? Is it different than maybe the people you talk to and your family at work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Louis Friedland is a professor emeritus in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communications. Lou, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
And Mike Wagner is a professor also in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike, thanks for joining us again.
Good to be back with you.
Well, Lou, can you talk about how this project got started and why you focused on Wisconsin in particular?
Well, Rob, the project actually got started more than 10 years ago in the wake of Act 10. And our research group started tracking what was going on in the state in terms of the degree of contentiousness, particularly the way that the politics in the wake of Act 10 was dividing people, dividing in some cases family members. And we thought that this was extreme. We thought it was remarkable. And of course, we're communication scholars, so we also wanted to understand how the communication environment, or the communication ecology as we call it, actually might be contributing to that contention. So we've been tracking it really for almost 12 years now. And this is the largest study of a single state's communication environment, we believe, that's ever been done. We have years and years of data at every layer of Wisconsin's communication ecology. And indeed, we are finding that people, surprisingly, not surprisingly to most people who've been following this, are becoming more divided, although we can see this developing over a long period of time here.
Mike, can you tell us what goes into someone's communication ecology?
Sure. It really is an understanding of all of the different elements that are at play when it comes to how we learn and decide what we believe, decide what we say and express to others, and decide what we do. And so it includes the people we talk to about politics. It includes the local television news we might watch, the local newspapers we might subscribe to or read or browse online. It refers to national television news from broadcast sources like your classic NBC, ABC, CBS. It refers to cable news that you might watch on places like Fox News or MSNBC. It relates to your social media behavior and the people in those social media networks who might share information about politics or misinformation about politics or contentious conversations with you or people you know about politics. And so it's really, you know, from who we talk to face to face to what we passively watch, read, listen to on the radio, talk radio, and news radio as well, and the social media outlets that we get information from. And those things, of course, have local elements, they have regional and state elements, national and international elements, and it is really complicated to try to figure out how all of these things are associated with what people know, want, and do, which is why I suspect nobody does it except for us. It's just, it's a lot of work.
Lou, one of the old political cliches is that all politics are local. The new political cliche is that local politics and state politics are getting nationalized. That's one of the things you tried to sort out in this book. What kind of conclusions did you draw there about how much national politics sway things in a state like Wisconsin?
Well, that is one of the big focuses of our book, Rob, and we have found that, of course, politics has become more nationalized. People take their partisan, take their cues from the parties and those and national cable television environments, national media environments. But we found that really it depends more on the issue and location, that there is more variation than many political scientists would have found and expect, that depending on the issue. We looked at three issues, immigration, health, and the economy through the lens of Foxconn. And we found that different people have different takes on these issues depending on, as Mike was saying a few minutes ago, their media diets or repertoires, their social networks, their geography. It's not so radically different. If they're hardcore partisans, they're likely to still take their cues from the National Democratic or Republican parties. But there's a lot of people in the middle. And that's one big lesson, is that many people, maybe even most people, most of the time, are still making sense of their lives and the issues through the lens of their local community.
Mike, one thing that struck me from a vantage in the media, we might get a picture that there's a lot of people out there on the left with their media diet and a lot of people out there on the right with their media diet. And that's all we might experience sometimes. There's a lot of people who just don't follow news that closely that might not be represented, say, on a call-in talk show.
That's right. There are plenty of people who did not wake up today and think to themselves, how will I hold my government accountable? Or they didn't wake up today and say, oh, I wonder who I'll hear on Central Time this afternoon. Plenty of people are in what some of our colleagues, Yana Krupnikoff and John Barry Ryan, call the other divide, right? So there's the left-right Democratic-Republican political divide, and then there's a divide between people who really are interested in politics and follow the news and have a kind of an omnivorous craving for different sources, and those who check out of politics, or they might think it doesn't affect me, or they might think no matter what I do, it's not going to matter. And so there's a lot of different reasons people might not be a part of regular engagement in politics. And so they're a group of people we ought to pay close attention to. But it's also the case that we overstate how many people are in a right-wing or left-wing partisan media echo chamber. There are certainly people who live in those kinds of spaces and consume those sorts of media and have those kinds of social media conversations. But a lot of people have very diverse information diets, because don't forget, it's not just whether you just watch Fox News all the time, it's also who you talk to at the gym and who you talk to when you're walking your dog around the block and what's on your local television news. And so it's a much more mixed set of information that most people get most of the time, which is what makes it so complicated to try to understand carefully.
We are talking to Lewis Friedland and Mike Wagner, both from UW-Madison, both co-authors, a group of co-authors involved in this book called Battleground, Asymmetric Communication Ecologies and the Erosion of Civil Society in Wisconsin. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Your observations about your own media diet, that of the people around you, 800-642-1234. Matt joins us now in Madison. Matt, hi.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to, I followed politics my entire life, and then I have witnessed in years is a willingness of people to accept disinformation, even outright lies. Now, some of the people believe the propaganda or the disinformation or the lies. They sincerely believe that. But there's some, I believe, that know that it's disinformation. They know they're lies, but they utilize them anyway.
Matt, thanks for the call. Lou, I know one of the things you're hoping to track in the book is how mis and or disinformation spreads, what we can do about it. Any thoughts for Matt?
Right. Well, I do want to say that how disinformation spreads is itself a whole other complicated subfield. So we're trying to create a framework in which we might track mis or disinformation, but we don't do that in the book much. That said, we do find a parallel to the findings of others like group at Harvard who wrote an important book called Network Propaganda, that there are asymmetrical media worlds. And what I mean by that is that, not surprisingly to most of the listeners here, there's a hyper-conservative or even hyper-conservative media environment that consists of cable news, but in this state, most importantly, conservative or even ultra-conservative talk radio. And of course, then that's amplified by people's social media. So you have a kind of a end-to-end ecosystem that's relatively more closed off. The what we might call the center or the center liberal even media ecosystem, although it's not particularly as partisan and directly in any sense, is much more open, much more related to mainstream media, including WPR. So there are two, if you want to think of it this way, different media worlds, and that does, as you might imagine, tremendously affect people's susceptibility to dis or misinformation.
Thanks for the call, Matt. We're talking to UW-Madison journalism professors Lou Friedland and Mike Wagner. They're two of the authors of the new book, Battleground, looking at political conversation, communication, and media in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What sources do you use for your political media? Do you consume some kind of political media on a daily basis? Or do you try to take breaks from it? Maybe big breaks. Do you see divisions among people you know over who they turn to, who they trust for information? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with UW-Madison journalism professors Lou Friedland and Mike Wagner. They're two of the authors who contributed to the new book, Battleground, looking at the role of media and communication in Wisconsin's political divide. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do conversations with people in your life shape your political views? Do you talk about politics with people in your life, or do you avoid those conversations? Where do you go for news and information? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Mike, one big part of the research for this book involved conversations, a couple hundred people, I believe, from around Wisconsin. And sometimes you might start with what seems like a political stereotype and things get nuanced the longer you talk to people. What kind of things did you and your colleagues learn from those conversations?
You know, that's exactly right. People are very complex. And we, you know, as social scientists and also just as human beings, right, often try to categorize the world into simple categories like liberal and conservative or moderate and those kinds of things. And what we learn when we and our students go out and talk to people and ask them what's on their mind and what issues do they care about and how do they encounter information about important matters like politics and local politics, we find people often speaking in ways that seem contradictory if you were going to try to categorize them in a neat little liberal or conservative box, right? And so we learned this time and time again in the conversations that we had with people where someone might say, you know, it's super important to have rules about who can come into the country, talking about immigration. And then saying, but it's really important for people in my part of the state, in agricultural part of the state, to have, you know, people who are willing to come in and work hard and help us, you know, with our harvest. And oftentimes it's immigrants who do some of that work. And so then you see the openness and then you see, but really I only want people of value to come in. And so there's people who kind of, you know, saying multiple things all about the same issue. And so if you were to ask them on a scale of 1 to 5, you know, do you support a restrictive immigration policy or not? Like, it's hard to know how you would compare a numerical answer to the richness that you get when you talk to people. And of course, we try to do both of those things and then triangulate and say, where are we hearing the same story, no matter how we measure it, and where are we hearing different stories that add a level of complexity to what it means to live in our state and think carefully and deliberately together about important and contentious political issues.
Go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Marcus is with us in Madison. Marcus, hi.
Good afternoon, and Professors Friedman and Wagner. It's hardly surprising to me that communications professors would cite the media as the cause of the opinion divide in the United States. It's a bit self-serving, I think. But looking over the last 20 years, I always make sure to check after an election the national demographic maps about voting patterns. And the split is pretty clear. It's urban versus rural. The country outside of the major cities is red. The larger the city, the bluer it is.
Marcus, take your point. Thanks for calling. I don't know, Lou, that you guys were saying that the media caused the divide, but too, I think Marcus's main point, you do talk about that, and not just big cities, but if you look at Wisconsin counties, a town of a city of 1 or 2,000 is going to be bluer than the surrounding countryside. How did that play into your research?
Yeah, that's right, Rob. And I should say, we definitely are not saying the media causes this division of opinion. In fact, this study incorporated large swaths of sociology and other demographic analysis to understand what counties people were in, what their social networks were, assuming, in fact, precisely that communication isn't what's creating this. So that's actually not what we're saying. But we do find that yes, the bigger cities are bluer and the smaller cities are bluer than their rural surrounds. But nonetheless, that's part of the point, is that if you look at Wisconsin, it's not a giant red-blue divide. It's honeycombed, really. There's a series of, if you want to think of it, concentric circles where the closer you get to the core of even a smaller town, the bluer it is. Yes, not necessarily blue, I add. Could be red overall, but bluer than its surrounds. Then you go out further and it's redder, but then you start to get some overlapping circles. And that's where you get these really interesting patterns, because the state's not, quote, all red or all blue, all Milwaukee, Madison, or all, Northwest. There is a lot of overlap.
Let's go now to Dave in Augusta. Dave, hi.
Hello, Rob. Long time no talk. I've got an opinion with politics. I try to keep political discussions just among close friends and family. That may sound strange, but I tell you what, if somebody comes up to me on the street or at a restaurant or whatever and tries to tell me how they feel politically, it's a turnoff. It's a discussion that will never, ever resolve. That's the way I feel about it. Dave. You know, if somebody can't tell me, well, the reason you should go this way is because of this and this and this. I'm like, well, I don't feel that way.
Dave,
well,
thanks for the call. And Mike, I'm guessing that doesn't sound strange at all to a lot of people. We're maybe more and more reluctant to want to have a political conversation, except maybe with that inner circle that Dave mentioned.
Well, it's interesting. You know, we have the two groups that Dave talked about, and then there's a third group of people who are maybe our coworkers, right? So there's our close family that many of us are willing to engage in political talk with. And then there's the people who accost you in the line at a coffee shop that I think maybe Dave is talking about, who maybe you don't want to talk about politics with. But then there are people who, you know, you work with every day, and we find that there are different patterns of communication people have with their close family and friends on the one hand, and their coworkers on the other. And the more heterogeneous the group, and usually coworkers are a more diverse group of people than one's own family, the different kind of opinions we see people ultimately end up expressing. They tend to be a little bit less extreme in their views, a little bit more willing to hear from the other side. But as the caller was mentioning, you know, it's also the case that, and maybe perhaps especially in Wisconsin, a stranger walking up to you and letting you know why your political views are wrong is probably not something that's going to solve a lot of problems in short order.
Thanks for that call, Dave. Lou, a big thing that we've only touched on briefly, social media, something that's been changing over the course of your study, a moving target to this day. What kind of questions about social media are you and your colleagues still hoping to answer when it comes to social media and how it shapes our political communication?
Well, we have an enormous analysis of Twitter in the book, and particularly the way that media elites, or I should say political elites, and also journalists use Twitter, and how Twitter shapes the public discourse across those elite layers. But of course, most people are not on Twitter doing politics most of the time. Many people really are on Facebook, if they're on social media, the quote average person. And so, and Facebook is behind a very thick firewall. So that's the, one of our bigger questions moving forward, is the role that Facebook plays as a center for sharing opinion among like or maybe unlike other people.
And Mike, just in our last minute or so, what is your big open question coming out of this years of research?
One thing I'm really interested in is what sorts of behaviors can people engage in, and what are kinds of journalism that reporters and news outlets can engage in that can help us reweave or re-knit together the civic fabric, right? We call our book Battleground. You can get it at go.wisc.edu/battleground for free until March 6th. And one thing that, you know, we think about in the end is, what are ways out of this kind of behavior? How can we expose ourselves to people who are different than we are, to news sources that aren't going to just tell us what we want to hear, and social media platforms where we don't get into endless arguments that serve no purpose? What can we do to re-knit together our civic fabric is a big part of our next project.
Sounds like a good starting point for another conversation sometime. Mike, thanks for being with us.
We'll do it. Thanks for having us.
And Lou, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
Louis Friedland is a professor emeritus in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication, and Mike Wagner, a current professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communications. They're two of the authors of the new book, Battleground, Asymmetric Communication Ecologies and the Erosion of Civil Society in Wisconsin. Speaking of weaving the social fabric back, check out a conversation from earlier this week with David Haynes of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about their Wisconsin Weaver Project, looking at exactly that topic. Coming up after the news, we'll break down what President Biden said in last night's State of the Union speech and what it tells us about the administration's foreign and domestic priorities. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, ever heard of the Oshkosh All-Stars or the Minneapolis Lakers? We'll talk about the Midwestern influence on pro basketball. Now, President Joe Biden gave his first State of the Union address last night, coming at a difficult moment in world history.
Six days ago, Russia's Vladimir Putin sought to shake the very foundations of the free world, thinking he could make it bend to his menacing ways. But he badly miscalculated.
Biden talked about isolating Russia and supporting Ukraine, lines that got bipartisan standing ovations. And he talked about his domestic policy agenda, highlighting the toll of rising inflation and calling to improve law enforcement by funding the police. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were there parts of the address that you liked, parts that you weren't a fan of? What did you want to hear more or less about? Did the president talk about policies you care about? And what did you make of the Republican response from Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Kathleen Dolan is Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. Kathy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
As we mentioned there, a big moment in world history. I don't think a couple months ago we would have anticipated that the Russian invasion of Ukraine would play such a central role in the State of the Union address. What did you hear from the president last night on confronting that issue?
Well, I think the president was clear in his resolve that he will join with our European allies and other nations around the world to try to stop Putin from advancing into Ukraine, taking over Ukraine, or advancing beyond that, if that's part of his intention. As you say, it is a difficult time right now in the world, and people are, you know, hearkening back to the roots of the Second World War. And so I think it was pretty clear last night that the President Biden wanted to let the nation know that, you know, we are on what could be a dangerous path, and we have to stop it.
The president emphasized unity both among the U.S. and allies and in the American political scene. Did you get that feeling, as we've sometimes seen in State of the Union addresses at difficult times internationally, a show of support, a show of unity from both sides present?
Yes. You know, last night, from the members who were in the chamber, most of them were supportive, say most of the Republicans. I mean, you know, obviously we're used to the Democrats wanting to support anything President Biden might say. But the Republicans who were in the chamber last night, you know, largely appeared to be supportive of the things that the president was saying. You know, we do acknowledge that not all members of Congress were in the chamber last night. We do want to acknowledge that the Republican Party is having a little bit of a sort of internal struggle over this, because former President Trump just days ago said, you know, what a big fan he is of Vladimir Putin, and what he's doing was genius. And his first impeachment, you know, was around his treatment of Ukraine. So there is that tension. But last night we saw, you know, Republican support for President Biden's idea that you have to take on authoritarian dictators.
Moving to domestic issues, the economy, always a big piece of a State of the Union address. President Biden had some things to point toward, the infrastructure bill, and he was just in Wisconsin up in Superior earlier today talking about the infrastructure bill. Good job numbers, but also acknowledging high inflation, the impact that's having on American consumers. That was a big topic of the Republican response as well. What did you make of the way the president tackled those economic issues?
Well, you know, presidents are sort of often in a difficult place around economic issues. And I think that it is not surprising. Human nature, you know, tends to attach to the negative news, particularly given the last 2 years the world has experienced. So I do think that the White House and the Democrats in general have had a little bit of trouble getting the message out about job growth and about the strong jobs numbers that come out month after month. And that most people, you know, when they're paying attention, are focused on inflation. So I thought the president, you know, did a good job of what he sort of needed to do, which was to, you know, perhaps trumpet the job reports, but also to acknowledge the inflation and acknowledge the pain that it causes people at, you know, that individual or family level, and then talk a little bit about, you know, his plans to help try to contain inflation, or at least, you know, work with the Fed and the Fed members to try to deal with it.
I want to listen to another part of the speech now. The president is talking about crime, policing, and law enforcement.
We should all agree the answer is not to defund the police. It's to fund the police.
Can you talk about the politics of that sentence? It's gotten a lot of attention.
Sure. You know, so there are a couple of pieces. I think there's a historical piece, and by that I mean, you know, just in the last year or two. And then there's a very contemporary piece. And the historical piece, I think, is that there are perhaps some relatively small group of activists who would take the phrase defund the police at its literal face. I think most people do not support that notion of a complete defunding of police and moving to some alternative, but instead pairing police and safety enforcement with more social services, perhaps taking the burden off the police from performing the kinds of roles that they shouldn't necessarily be doing. And so I think over time that phrase defund the police has gotten a lot of traction, but in a way that doesn't represent where I think the majority of the Democratic Party is. And so what President Biden wanted to do last night, I think, was very clearly, you know, signal that he's in the center on these issues. You know, he knows he's speaking to people who are not just Democrats. And so he wants independent voters. He wants Republican voters, perhaps. He wants everybody to understand that he is not somebody who wants to defund the police, but, as he said, train them, you know, supply them, support them, give them the resources they need to do their jobs. And then he talked a little bit more broadly about some of the other kinds of societal needs we have that can be handled by other professionals in other arenas and not just policing.
Talking to Kathy Dolan, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, looking at last night's State of the Union address from President Biden and the Republican response delivered this year by Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds. Here's a listen to a part of that.
It feels like President Biden and his party have sent us back in time to the late 70s and early 80s, when runaway inflation was hammering families, a violent crime wave was crashing our cities, and the Soviet Army was trying to redraw the world map.
Can you talk away about the way that speech from Iowa's governor there tried to set up some of those issues, especially in a midterm election year?
Sure. So, you know, Governor Reynolds was chosen very carefully as somebody to give the Republican response, because I think leaders like Kevin McCarthy in the House and Mitch McConnell in the Senate, they want to put a face on the Republican Party that looks much more like Kim Reynolds than perhaps some other more extreme members of the party. And they want to use this as sort of an opening salvo on the kinds of issues that they will raise between now and the midterm elections, in November. So, you know, her attempts to try to draw parallels back to the 1970s certainly ignores the last 2.5 years of world history and the impact of the COVID pandemic on life. But, you know, in politics, we often see broad themes that aren't always, you know, rooted in all sorts of specifics, because, you know, her response was much like the president's, in that, you know, there are big top level issues without a lot of nitty gritty. So, you know, the Republicans will try to play on discontent or concern or anxiety or fear that people have, whether it's about their own personal issues or whether it's about international issues. And that, you know, is the job of the response. The job of the response is to make the case for the other political party.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dave is with us in Madison. Dave, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Dave?
Well, first of all, I'd like to compliment your show. Very well done.
Thanks.
And secondly, I would say it's Groundhog Day. Every State of the Union sounds very similar. One party touts what they've done or what they plan to do. The other party responds with a rebuttal that makes it sound like you live in the worst country in the world. And I guess I would argue, you know, we had a position where in 2016, if you look at the numbers, Bernie would have beat Trump. And Bernie got saboteured by the Democratic Party. And the Republican Party wanted no, absolutely did not want him to run against Trump.
Dave, and thanks for the call. I want to stick with the State of the Union and not go too far back to 2016. But his point, David, making there, Kathy, that these things can be pretty predictable. And my emails I've gotten from both parties, Republicans didn't like the speech, Democrats did. Does this really mean anything?
So first of all, let me just say to Dave, you know, shout out to Dave. There are very few political scientists who would agree with you that the numbers indicate that Bernie would have beaten Trump. Having said that, this is, yeah, I mean, Dave's exactly right that the State of the Union, as I said, you know, a second ago, is about the two parties laying out their positions. You know, I'm sure there were very few Democrats that enjoyed any of President Trump's State of the Union addresses, and Republicans loved them. So they, you know, the Constitution tells us that the president must come before Congress once a year and report on the State of the Union. And they do that. And over time, they have become, you know, bigger and grander and bolder and more media event-like. And then the other party has made a response. And this is the pattern. And this is how the two parties communicate. This is one of the sort of centerpiece items in a year. And we do have a midterm election this year. But in a year, say, you know, next year without elections, I mean, this is one of the big ways that the parties try to get people engaged, to offer them information, and to try to sway them.
Dave, thanks for that call. We're talking to Kathy Dolan, political scientist at UW-Milwaukee, with us to talk about what we heard in President Biden's first State of the Union address last night and the Republican response. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you hear? What do you wish you had heard about issues like Russia invading Ukraine, inflation, prescription drug costs, you name it. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about President Biden's State of the Union address last night and the Republican response. Kathy Dolan stays with us from UW-Milwaukee, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch or listen? Do you watch or listen to State of the Union addresses in general, or do you avoid them because you kind of know what they're going to look like? What do you want to see Democrats focus on? What do you want to see Republicans focus on as we head into this midterm election year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kathy, coming into this, a lot of the political talking heads types looked at this as a chance maybe for President Biden with low-ish approval ratings, worried about Democrats' prospects in this off-year election to try to reset, to set a new course. Did you see that happen? Was it something that was really possible?
Well, I mean, certainly in American politics, anything is possible, right? I will say that to me, it was very clear that the intention was to focus on unity where possible and to sort of track in the center for most of the speech. The kinds of things that he talked about beyond the big ticket items that you have already mentioned that we chatted about, more money for mental health, more money for fighting the opioid crisis, efforts to protect kids from the harm of social media. There were, a lot of things that I think most people would say, oh, yes, we enjoy those things. That makes sense. So I think it was a clear attempt to make the president's agenda, palatable and sort of centrist, because the Republicans are, always focused on the sort of extreme members of the party. And I also think that, he chose unity over the potential he could have done to kind of poke Republicans on issues, so obviously Ukraine was the opening and it was a way to start the speech by having, a moment of unity and standing ovation. But one thing that was completely missing from the speech was January 6th and the, dangers that our country faces from internal forces. Some people today, would have argued that he missed an opportunity to put the Republicans on record, as opposing the efforts to sort of get at the roots of what happened on January 6th. But others would say, he chose not to stick a finger in the eye of the Republicans. They certainly wouldn't have joined in the standing ovations and they would have sat there stone-faced. And so I think when he did kind of, poke across the aisle, it was, hey, why don't you guys confirm my appointments to the Fed? And then he talked about his nomination of Judge Ketanji, Jones Brown, to replace Stephen Breyer, and talked about her briefly, and let's get her nominated. So it was more of a sort of not jesting, but lighter treatment of the opposition.
Do State of the Unions, or States of the Union, I guess, do we have any record of whether they impact public opinion or change approval ratings or move the needle in any way?
The evidence we have suggests that they don't, that most of them don't do much. And I say most of them because most States of the Union addresses are, pretty typical and predictable, as you have suggested. Sometimes they're well watched, sometimes they're not. But I think one of the pieces from the Marquette University Law School's poll that you referred to today, the relatively low number of people who are really focused on either the gubernatorial or senatorial primaries here in Wisconsin, people like us who consume a lot of this media forget that the average person spent last night making dinner and taking a child to a soccer practice or, helping with homework or doing laundry, that, politics isn't always on the top of everyone's minds. And so, we find that people who tuned in last night are people who are already engaged and may or may not already have opinions, but probably have less room to be swayed in one direction or the other.
Talking to Kathy Dolan from UW-Milwaukee about last night's State of the Union address. Still time for your response at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Gary from Iron River emailed, said the speech sounded like part of a campaign. Gary thought it didn't focus enough on the U.S. and that Biden didn't appeal to members of the Republican Party, ultimately sounding out of touch, Gary says. These speeches in an election year are definitely part of a campaign, right, Kathy?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they are in some ways campaign speeches. I mean, because, you know, people have to remember that presidents can't do a lot of things unilaterally that they want to do. So if President Biden wants Congress to pass a bill to increase funding for efforts to fight the opioid crisis in this country, he is using the State of the Union to sort of, you know, speak to the public, to put a little pressure on Congress, to ask them to pass legislation to increase that funding. So it does have kind of a campaign feel because he is sort of, you know, campaigning to get Congress to do the kinds of things that he wants done. So I don't think Gary is wrong, but I also don't think that that in and of itself is a negative. Lots of Americans tend to find almost anything related to politics as a negative. And those of us who sort of study it for a living, I think, can identify lots of ways in which it is a positive or at least a neutral.
And I wanted to bring up decorum at these things, Kathy. Some years back, we had a congressman, Joe Wilson, yelling, "You lie," during President Obama's address. Nancy Pelosi tearing up a copy of Donald Trump's address. And now last night, we had a Republican member of Congress heckling President Biden, bringing up the deaths of American service members in Afghanistan in the heckling. But as President Biden was starting to talk about his own son's death, possibly due to exposure to chemicals during his time in the service, what do you make of that outburst in that moment?
Well, you know, there were actually the two. Mm-hmm. Lauren Boebert, a member of the House from Colorado, was the one who decided to sort of chide President Biden about veterans issues as he was about to speak about his late son. And then Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene, a member of the House from Georgia, they yelled a few things out about building the wall and keeping out immigrants when the president was talking about immigration policy. I guess I would say that I would be somebody who doesn't think that looks makes members of the House of Representatives look particularly good. I think, you know, if you chose to be there last night, because all members were not there last night, if you chose to be there, you know, listen and don't make it about yourself. Marjorie Taylor Greene gave her own personal response last night, you know, so members of the House and the Senate always are looking for their own campaign moments and their own sort of attention. And I think both of those women are people from whom that behavior was not surprising.
And just our last minute, Kathy, what are you watching for now as President Biden turns to trying to make some of those priorities last night into actual policy that gets passed in Congress?
The Democratic majority in the House of Representatives is large enough that the House will probably be responsive to a number of the legislative initiatives the president will put forward. The 50-50 split in the Senate is obviously going to make things harder, because we have seen for the last year or so that there are even Democrats who aren't interested or necessarily as supportive of passing some of those initiatives. The Supreme Court nomination will also make things more complex because that will take up a lot of time and attention and bandwidth in the Senate, and that is certainly going to become a priority. And so I think the problem that we've seen in the Senate is that it has become a kind of a serial actor. You know, they can't seem to be doing multiple things at a time. There tend to be a couple of big things that are taking up a lot of the time in negotiation. And so the Supreme Court nomination is clearly going to be a big deal for the next few months. The Democrats would like to move it through, you know, as quickly as possible, try to get it wrapped up by April.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks, Kathy, for joining us. That was Kathleen Dolan, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, looking at the State of the Union Address. Tomorrow in the morning show, Mike Gallagher, Republican congressman from Wisconsin, talks about Ukraine. That's tomorrow at 7 on the Ideas Network. On last week's edition of Food Friday, we talked about cheese, and now Wisconsin is playing host to the big game of cheese. The World Championship Cheese Contest is going on right now at the Monona Terrace Convention Center in Madison. As reported by our own Diane Bazooka, it's not just about cheese. There are also butter and yogurt competitions. When the whole thing wraps up, we'll most likely bring on Central Time cheese fan and former cheesemonger Dean Kinnetter for some highlights. The early word is that Wisconsin isn't cleaning up in the individual categories. Lots of second and third place showings, only a couple of firsts. In the meantime, what is your all-time favorite cheese? What do you give a medal to, literally or figuratively? Tweet us at CentralTimeWPR or email centraltime@WPR.org. Cheese news you can use. This is Central Time.